So I'm Joel and I'm an addict.
Hey, Joel.
And John made the dire mistake of telling me to speak as long as I'm comfortable. So consider yourself hostage. I want to say the first time I came here to check it out, when Don was talking about starting a meeting here, I saw that bookshelf and immediately felt good. Sometimes we in this world, in any group whatsoever, whether it's where we work, where we recover, where we worship, whatever, we get in this clubby thing where us and them and that type of stuff. And that bookshelf is not that at all. Yeah. It's representative of an open mind. Yeah. So I was immediately attracted to what's happening in this room. So I'll give you, since we've known each other a couple hours, and you trust me and I trust you, because we got no boundaries whatsoever. I'll give you a little window into my head, and that is sometimes when I come and share my story, I have a little tug of war in my head between what my sponsor told me and what I want. What my sponsor told me is to say, higher power, help me do and say the things that you would have me do. And he taught me to do that before anything that felt important right here, right? Whether it's going to work the first time or getting a paycheck and trying to figure out money, whatever. Higher power, help me do and say the things you would have me do. And then the other piece is the person that grades myself in everything I do and rates myself on a scale of 1 to 10 and why and analysis. So there's a tug of war between that. Just that humility and respect for what this is for and why we do it. And then the, I want to do a good job so you guys think I'm cool. I actually heard an AA speaker at that Big Danville meeting many, many moons ago say that we're part dog and part cat. And it was before the cartoon Cat Dog or whatever it is. And the dog is like, I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy, right? I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy, right? Right? I'm a good boy. And the cat is like, I don't care. Just take care of me. And to simultaneously have both of those energies in us is a pretty remarkable thing. So the first step is really important to me because I attempted recovery or whatever, as far as I could figure it out multiple times. I got into a mix really fast. I think my mom had developed some boundaries suddenly. She kicked my dad out. She says that she kicked my dad out when her three sons started to talk to her the way my dad talked to her. So all of a sudden, she had to figure it all out without him. And she went to nursing school and started calling my probation officer, and just all kinds of stuff changed suddenly. And I went to a program, and no convincing required. 16 years old, didn't argue with anybody when they told me I was an addict. I had no comeback, no reservations about that part, that first part of the first step, the idea of powerlessness. You didn't have to convince me. I wasn't arguing about I'm only hurting myself. I didn't do any of that fight. I was like, oh, man, let me get my stuff together. Because there was always a quiet voice inside of my head that said that that life had to be temporary because I didn't feel proud of myself. Because I hit the ground running. I didn't have any cute partying for very long. And, you know, it's like immediately upon use, if I was at home, I was missing something. And I was calling around to friend after friend before cell phones and pagers, and they weren't at home. So I knew I was missing something. So I was out and about, never holding still. Never at my house for long. There was a period of time where I was trying really hard to do good, which means don't get caught. And I was coming home at my curfew at 9 o'clock and jumping out my window at 10:30 when my mom went to bed because she was working at a skilled nursing facility and she was exhausted. So she was crashed out and I'm out the window. And that's the longest period of time I would spend at home for as long as I could. So Couple little hang-ups. Mom's not messing around. She's calling the PO. She's calling the judge. Home arrest. Jumped over the back window to smoke a joint or something. Jumped a back fence. Jumped back over. Mom was there. She's on the phone. So I was in and out of juvenile hall, and they sent me to a program. Had me convinced I was in huge trouble if I didn't go to this program. And I went to a program, and H and I came in and graduated this program. And me and a bunch of little 17-year-old clowns went driving all over the Bay Area going to any meeting that was available. AANA convention in San Francisco. And we were just driving in this little Geo Metro all over the place, going to meetings, didn't know nothing. I do remember somebody interrupting my friend when he was sharing, telling him to shut up and stop feeling sorry for himself. it was a little bit old school at some of those meetings. But I wanted it, you know, and by the time I was done with aftercare, I had two jobs, one at Target, one for a property manager. I was going to independent study, and I was 17 years old and looking pretty good. Looking back now, I kind of understand what I missed. It was recovery. the NA book says social acceptability does not equal recovery. So at that age, a pattern developed of social acceptability where I would get a job, get some money in my pocket, try to get a car, try to get a place to live, try to get a girlfriend, and get loaded. There was like a ground zero that I could reach. And then I just drifted until I got loaded. It was just kind of, it felt like a locked in kind of pattern. I did it so many times. Between 16 and 26, I moved probably 8 or 9 times between states. I turned 18, I was scared. So I went to another state to not be in trouble. Started getting in trouble there, moved back, started getting in trouble here, moved back, went to another state for a little while, Nebraska. I don't even know what was going on. But I learned real quick, don't tell them dudes I'm from California. Cause they knew I was up to something. But every time I would move somewhere, I'd have this little blip in time where I'd end up working. I'd end up looking okay for a minute and then I would get loaded. And then the very last time, every time I went to meetings too, a matter of fact, the first time I moved to my brother's house in Utah, there was an Alano Club right around the corner. Like my cordless phone could almost reach that far. You know, I walked it one time talking to somebody until it went out. I was almost to the Alano Club. And they had Friday night candlelight meetings and you could smoke. And I'm like, I just knew I had to be there on Friday night or I'd be somewhere else. You know, I was 18 years old trying to figure it out. However, I wasn't like getting a sponsor and working the steps or anything smart. You know, I had to like work a modified program, cut it with a little bit of Joel or something. I mean, I just, same thing over and over, same thing over and over. You know, and the last time my mom had been around you guys enough and treatment programs enough that she looked me in the eye one time and said, you know, if you don't get a support group of recovering people, you're going to get loaded again. And I said, I know. I got it. I know. And I went to a meeting in Vallejo, Indiana and Colusa, Wednesday night. And it was upstairs and they were still smoking in that upstairs church. We were so rude. We would smoke in a church if they let us, man. Anyway, I can't believe they still let us have meetings there. I went to that meeting, and I remember holding the hands, and what I was supposed to do when I get there, because I knew, right? My little checklist of all my solutions was all filled out. All the checkboxes of try this, try this, try this, try this was all filled out except for one checkbox. Get a sponsor and work the steps and do it as prescribed. Right? Move to another state. Check, tried that. Have a sober girlfriend. Check, tried that. Just like I tried everything else except for that. So I knew what I was supposed to be doing. And I walked into that meeting with every intention to say, my name is Joel. I'm an addict. I've been clean for this long and I haven't done any work at all and I need some help. I knew what to do and didn't do it. We went keep coming back. It, and I might have been gone before they finished. Right? Spun out. I think the only thing that stopped me on the way out was a girls' program van was there. And I stopped and said hi or something like that. And then I was gone. And it was this weird little thing where I was outside of myself, observing myself, go through the motions of my days for 3 or 4 months until I relapsed. And a part of me knew it was going to happen, and I wasn't. All that stuff about craving and wanting to get loaded, none of that stuff was true. It was just by default, if I wasn't driving the car, that's where it went. Right? If I wasn't intentional about doing something different, that's where it went. And I took my hands off the wheel, and 4 months later, you know, I'm feeling like a grown man smoking a joint out the window on the way home from work. And then 2 weeks later, I'm doing other stuff, throwing up on the way to get dope. Because I hated what I was doing, man. And I was out there 4 months, and then on December 31st, 1999, December 30th, I got arrested and I got bailed out. And then December 30th, they found a new charge and I got arrested again. And they usually don't let you bail out a second time within 24 hours. And it was Y2K, which means the jail was really scared about their cameras. But my clean date ended up being January 1st, 2000. So the year is my clean time. That's how I remember it. If we're in 25, I have 25 years clean. And the first step, like I said, is really important to me. I accepted powerlessness for years. I accepted it. But that idea of unmanageability, I can't control my consequences. So powerless, I can't control my use. Got it. Right? But if I could control my consequences, I'd still be getting loaded. I promise you. In my head, I was like, give me an extension cord out to the trailer in the field behind your house and I'll be okay, right? Just if no one bothers me and just lets me do my thing, that's all I need. My standards were so low. I couldn't even manage to like have a relationship with someone long enough to borrow their extension cord to have a trailer behind their house. Like they weren't doing that because I was probably jumping in the house and taking a shower while they were gone or something like that. But I just couldn't buy that unmanageability thing until the last part, you know. And to me, this is the way I think of it. And somebody told me this is if I can't manage my life, somebody else will do it for me. And his name was Commissioner Mike Nails. And I had just this bright light go in my head when this guy was sitting there on the stand. What do they call a stand? Anyway, the judge was sitting up there and he had ultimate power over the next period of my life. And it just all of a sudden it was disgusting to me that this guy who didn't know me, never sat with me and talked to me, never asked me any questions about what's important to me or my life story or none of that stuff, was going to pop open this probation recommendation and decide what was going to happen to me. The idea of losing my freedom on that level all of a sudden wasn't okay. And I've heard a lot of people's stories about their bottoms and stuff like that. I had worse situations, I promise you. I had things that should have been my bottom, moments of clarity. My mom said one time when she saw me, I looked like a skeleton with saran wrap for skin. I looked so bad, you know. Those times should have been bottoms, but I don't know what it was about this situation. That's what made me accept the unmanageability of my disease of addiction, was that so many times other people got to manage my life. So I was a version of willingness. I was mustering the most willingness I can. Like there's a version of humility when you know, so like bad self-esteem, good common sense, right? I was watching myself over and over and over do those things I swore I wouldn't do again. So it made sense for me not to be proud of myself, not to have confidence, not to feel competent and respectable. So my self-esteem was, my poor self-esteem was good common sense, right? So it was a version of humility. I was humiliated. I understood the darkness I was capable of. There's a real version of humility when you understand that you're capable of every bad thing everybody is, but also every good thing everybody is. I didn't have that second part yet, but I did have willingness. But I also had like a pretty serious desire for comfort, which kind of battled my willingness a lot of times. You know, like I'm talking to them about treatment and trying to get the best situation I possibly can in sentencing. You know, I want this program, not that program. They let you smoke. They don't let you smoke. I look back on it and I was like, I should have just been happy to be alive, man. You know, because we all know people that did the exact same things we did that are not alive. So I should have had a different level of humility, but I was just too immature. So went to a program and instead of jail, got out of that program. And I'm in sober living. And so the pain is a little bit distant by now. You know, they made me do a little jail time. They made me go to this program. 12 months have passed and I've been doing push-ups, you know. So some of that pain was a little bit distant. I had some desperation. I had the fear of relapse, but not the hunger for recovery, if that makes any sense. I think a lot of us spin our wheels in the place of like not liking the consequences, but really not focusing on what do I do next. So I was there. There was a part of me that was kind of waiting for the relapse monster to sneak up on me. I remembered that feeling I had of just watching it happen. So there was a part of me that was like watching for danger. Any clue that I wasn't okay. In that program, somebody would say something that I felt was important, and I was so scared to relapse that I'd be mad that I didn't have a pen or pencil to write it down, because what if I forgot what they said and what if I got loaded because of it, right? I was just so scared, but I was also comfortable. These people were taking care of me. I had sober living. All I had to do was donate 8 hours a week to help out at the place, right? So I started going to meetings to get away from these clowns in the sober living and program so I could stop being treated like a client, right? So I could go somewhere where I was a person. And nobody told me what to do and held me accountable. I made the mistake of trying meetings where they actually kind of held you accountable. What followed was a series of invitations. And to this day, I don't know what would have happened without them. It was some really simple things, some very simple things. This program I was at was huge on honesty. So when I'm walking out of a meeting and these two guys introduce themselves to me and they say, you coming back next week? And I said, yeah. I was like, crap, now I got to come back because I'm trying to be an honest person. So I went back to that meeting, and that meeting became a regular meeting, Friday night J Street meeting of NA. I don't know why I'm pointing that way. I think Benicia's over there. My compass is off. So I went back to that meeting regularly, and these two guys, man, I greeted them and they remembered my name and like talked to me about stuff. And one of them was like out of work and having a hard time, and he had a year clean, you know, and I had a year clean doing time and program. But he wasn't like the NA commercial where everything will be great if you just do this. He was like real, you know. And so I appreciated hearing him ante up and talk to me about what he was worried about and what the solution is. So I had some conversations, and then I speak up in a meeting, and I always say this, and this guy denies it. He'll deny it. I might believe him one day, but I spoke up in this meeting, and the guy came up to me afterwards and he said, I really related to what you had to say, and there's this other meeting you might like. I think he meant, dude, you need more recovery. That stuff you were talking was a little bit wacky. I mean, that's the way I heard it looking back. Looking back on that experience, I was like, he was helping me, you know. But he invited me to another meeting, and I went to another meeting that he invited me to. At this meeting, it was pretty small, very respectful meeting. There was something about this meeting. Nobody got up to go to the bathroom while people were talking. I don't know why I noticed this. I just noticed the level of respect that everybody had for each other. Nobody was distracting. Nobody was looking at anything else. People were nodding their head. I see you. People were nodding their head. It just felt like love and respect, you know. And these people had a tradition every other week, which seems like a lot to me, but whatever. Every other week, going out to the movies. And they'd invite me, and I'd say, no, I got something to do on a Saturday night. Whatever. I'd make some excuse, and then I went to the movies with them. And they, instead of going to the Vallejo movies, which would have took moments from the Lighthouse meeting to there, it would have took moments to get to the movies. They got on the freeway and were heading out. I'm like, where are we going? We're going to Fairfield, which was enough time in this van that I was hostage and they could interrogate me about how are you doing with your recovery? What are you doing for your recovery? Do you have a sponsor? Thankfully, I'm a bit of a people pleaser because I gave them the best answer a job interview could offer. And that is, oh yeah, I got it narrowed down to three guys. I'm going to ask someone to be my sponsor. And I mean, I don't even like three people. So I don't know where I got the number three. There was two people I might've considered, but I don't know what was happening. And then they asked me about it enough times in a row, particularly one guy asked me about it that I set a goal date. And it was the first time I've ever done that, and it might have been to appease him, and it might have been something in my spirit locking it in. I don't know what it was, but I said, you know, I'm going to have a sponsor by July 15th. It was sometime in the summer. I don't remember the date. I said, I'm going to have a sponsor by July 15th. And he said, all right, man, I'm rooting you on. I can't wait to see who your sponsor is, and I can't wait to see you blossom. And that's awesome, brother. That's great to hear. He was encouraging no matter what I said. That date happened to be on a Saturday. That meeting happened to be on a Saturday. I put off asking someone to be my sponsor until that date. And if he would not have been there, I don't know what I would have done. I would have missed my date. And he walked up to me and he said, dude, it's the 15th. I can't wait to hear what happened. Did you get a sponsor? And I was kind of like at the sixth grade dance again, kind of looking at my feet. And that's what it felt like. And I said, and the best I could do, and I get emotional every time I say this, the best I could do was, actually, man, I was gonna ask you. And he said, it would be an honor and a privilege to sponsor you. And I think about that. We were talking about some stuff from the past. And I think about that and how hard that was for me and how sick to my stomach I was asking that guy. And then I think about how the first time I did LSD, I was scared to death and I powered through it and threw that little thing in my mouth. And the first time I tried another drug, I was scared to death and I powered through it and ingested that substance. And the first time I stole something from a store, I was scared to death and I powered through it. But to ask another man for help would have me come up short, right? Thank goodness he was participating. Thank goodness. I didn't know at the time. I didn't know for years. I was probably telling my story when I figured out he was volunteering every time he stood in front of me. He was volunteering, man. And if that wouldn't have happened, those series of invitations didn't happen, where would I be? I don't know. I heard a speaker say, and this has a little biblical language, so if that puts you off, translate it, because I don't know how. But he said, and this makes sense even if you don't have biblical language yourself, he said he feels like with his power, he went through three phases. The first phase was mercy. When you're actively using, like I said, you're doing some of the stuff that got other people killed, but somehow you survive it and you get into recovery. The next phase is grace. You're clean, but you don't know what you're doing. It's clumsy, it's awkward, it's forced, it feels so incompetent doing things for the first time that you're not comfortable with. And you're doing some things wrong and you're dating some wrong people and you're not doing what your sponsor said. And somehow you stay clean through it. And that period is grace. And then you start intentionally working the program that was prescribed, and that period is favor. That's when you enter a real relationship with your higher power, and it's not by accident, that you're doing it. It's by choice. I will share that I feel like my choice came at the 10th step. I told you I was scared of that little invisible monster coming up and sneaking up on me. There was a part of me that expected the relapse. I don't know how I got through it or how I ignored it, but it's just that I had experienced the same thing enough times in a row that I expected my history to continue to be my story. And I had to create a new history, and I had to be intentional about it, and I had to notice that I was doing something different in order to believe a different possibility could happen. And that happened for me in the 10th step. The NA Step Working Guide has 100 questions for the 10th step. It's not the way my sponsor had me do it. Thank you. I've done that step, 10th step, for 30 days in the past. 100 questions. There's also another pamphlet in NA that has an equal amount of questions that you can use for the 10th step. But him and I worked a 10th step off basic working of a program and questions about defects of character that we had identified. They're real simple ones, right? And then we added a couple questions that were really important to me. One is, was there anything left undone today that needs to be done promptly tomorrow? Right? And it was like my list of things, like returning my box to Comcast. Now, if I had a list of 3 or 4 things that I was supposed to be doing that I didn't get done, my self-esteem started lowering, right? It was just the weirdest thing, man. If I was supposed to talk to somebody about something related to work, related to school, anything, if it was on my to-do list and too many to-dos stacked up, I started feeling incompetent and lowered self-esteem. Is there a tissue somewhere? Yeah.
Thank you.
One will do. I'm not going to cry again. Just kidding. What did I leave undone today that I need to get done? And then the second thing was, what did I do today that I'm proud of that I'd like to repeat tomorrow? Those were monumental. So the relapse monster moved from back here, right here, from back here to visible. I can see you. I can make a choice every day how I handle you. You know, I can choose recovery. It became a concrete thing where I could take action and know if I had done it, right? It wasn't like early recovery when someone would say, oh, just have faith. And I'd be like, how do I know when I'm done? Don't be mystical with me. Tell me where to send my feet, right? So it became concrete, and the relapse monster went from an apparition to an actual thing, and I understood how my defects of character came into play. And I got a lot of relief the first time I worked the steps. I don't know if I understood exactly what I did, right? I followed all the processes. I did what was told. I didn't really get the cause and effect so much. I understood some of the amends things, because as soon as I went over my list of amends with my sponsor, somebody I hadn't thought of appeared in front of me at a store. And I went, bro. And I made amends to him in a very simple way. I was slightly coached. We hadn't like made a plan yet. I knew enough to keep it simple. I knew enough not to say, do you forgive me? Do you forgive me? Right? I knew just enough to say, hey, man, you gave me a shot at this job and I blew it. And I totally took advantage of the situation, you know, and I really hope that didn't have a negative impact on you, and if there's anything I can do to make it right. He goes, what are you talking about? I don't even remember that. I was like, but cool, I feel good. It was really important to have this practice situation right in front of my face. If I would have had to start with the hard ones, that would have been something else. I wasn't ready, you know. I probably would have made amends than made excuses. Anyway, so I got through the steps the first time, and then I do what many people do, where I maybe felt like I had arrived somewhere. I think what happens for me is I was afraid of life for so long, I didn't understand that recovery was not going to be a choice between good and bad. I thought it was going to be between good and bad was so tempting. Right. But it ended up being a choice between good and better. Right. So I got really focused on my roles. I'm a boyfriend. I'm a student. I'm an employee. And this is weird because people think I'm good at it. Right. I went back to school and I'm there an hour early, nervous. I've got a mechanical pencil, a regular pencil, a blue pen, a black pen, a spiral notebook with paper, regular leaf paper. I didn't know what I was going to need, so I brought everything. Hour early, door's not even open. I'm sitting in the hallway, right? And then 2 weeks later in class, the teacher announces a project, and my group that they had assigned, by the way, I still hate that. If you're a teacher, I haven't worked out that resentment. They formed a group. They explained what the group was going to do, and everyone looked at me and said, "Joel, what do we do?" And I'm like, "I don't know what the hell's going on here, but this is not reality." But you know, it felt good to be a student doing extra credit, even though I already had an A, because I'm not obsessive or anything. And be a worker and kind of like the dream job. I was working graveyards where I could just do my homework and watch movies and like shortened version of hockey game, right? They had to shave off some of the time so you missed the dry part. It's all dry hockey. Anyway, I got really focused on those roles and kind of forgot the things that got me there. I read somewhere in a book, someone shared a quote, and then I translated it to recovery. You know, will you pursue recovery out of priority or pain? When the pain was relieved, I hadn't yet made it a priority in my life to have like a constant 12 steps in my daily affairs, you know, to hold up my problems at work according to the steps. You know, I saw my sponsor at a meeting and he asked me if I bought a new really heavy phone because I wasn't picking it up. You know, and a little phenomenon happened. I got an internal clock, but somebody give me a dirty look if I'm doing too much. Okay. a phenomenon happened in that time where I would like drift and return to unmanageability in my head. Where the way I talked to myself was too intense, the way I talked to the people around me was too intense. I'd be participating in gossip. That old negative energy started coming back. You know, unmanageability always first happens in my brain where no one can see it. And then it happens in my behavior. And I was feeling fairly proud of who I'd become. You know, like a really strict code of honesty on some level, except I didn't realize I was being dishonest if I told you I was fine, right? I thought I was being honest if I didn't steal. So I was feeling pretty good about myself. And I would drift and it would feel ugly and I wouldn't feel proud of myself. So I'd call my sponsor, do a little plan, work a little program. 2 and 3 weeks later, I'd be doing better. Matter of fact, I went to my sponsor one time and I'm like, "You got to tell me what to do here. I'm thinking about breaking up with my girlfriend." He goes, "Well, I mean, if that's what you decide, that's what you can do. But first, let's get grounded, right? Before you make that decision, why don't we do this? How many meetings are you going to go to in the next 2 weeks?" I was like, whatever I said, 6, I don't know. He goes, "Okay. You're going to bring up any topics at the meetings? You want to bring up the topic of relationship at the meeting if you have the opportunity? You want to tell like 2 people what's going on with you? And then we'll check in about it for 2 weeks. You guys have been together for a while now. I don't think you want to rush into this decision to break up." I'm all right. So I do that and I'm calling him, you know, every other day like we planned. And we're talking about stuff. And he says, "We're not going to make a decision about the relationship. We're just going to do the plan. Stick to the plan. Get out of your head, get into action. Out of your head, into action." So 2 weeks later, he says, "So here we are 2 weeks later. How you doing with that problem with your girlfriend?" And I was like, "What problem?" You know, so it's like going to meetings and hearing people tell the truth and getting into the literature and talking to my sponsor and being accountable always changed my perspective. But when I stopped doing that, my perspective could always move right back. You know, that's one thing I've learned, like that's an absolute truth, is whatever I think is good and true and helpful and important right this minute, if I work a solid program for 90 days, I might feel different. If I don't do anything for 90 days, guaranteed to feel different. What I think is true and important, like I'll feel sorry for myself when 90 days ago I would have never, you know. So the phenomenon that happened was consequence tolerance. You know, we always think about tolerance in terms of how many beers we can drink. But I learned consequence tolerance. At first, getting a little bit squirrely didn't feel safe. So I'd get back into working a program. And then I'd drift a little bit, and I'd go, uh-oh, and get back in. I'd drift a little bit, and go, uh-oh, and get back in. And then before long, I was more comfortable with the drift. And I could drift farther, and I could be dishonest, and I could, you know, et cetera. And maybe it's time to close with this. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see in a second. right around this time, so the relationship ended, and it should have ended. It wasn't like crash and burn because I wasn't working a program. Neither of us were working a program. We weren't the same people that started dating in early recovery because we'd been to meetings and worked the steps and we're two different people. We could have figured it out, but neither of us like wanted to do the work or something. I don't know. Relationship's over. I'm going through one of those recovery midlife crisis, and I decided that I needed to like do the basics of recovery, man. So I get back into the steps another time. I'm working with my sponsor. We're meeting every Tuesday. I get a service commitment. I get a habit of praying in the morning and at night. And I just do those simple things, right? And I get the secretary commitment at a Sassoon meeting. And somebody gives me a phone number of a guy that's got 34 years. And I'm like, woo, right? And he comes and speaks. And then he tells that he got clean on, like, I don't remember the date, like June 6th, 1973. And yo, I was born May 31st, 1973. And I'm like, oh, he's been taken in recovery as long as I've been taking in oxygen. He's got to have it. So I'm like on the edge of my seat listening. Here comes the magic. He's going to give me the magic. And by the time he's done sharing, it's a great share. Solid recovery. I'm like, he didn't say nothing. I don't know. I'm judgy. And then at the end of the meeting, at the end of his share, he says, you know, the longer I've been clean, the more I realize you can't escape the basics. Regular meeting attendance, working the steps with your sponsor, being of service, conscious contact with your higher power, right? And he just listed it just like that. He says, I've tried a variety of modifications and only stayed clean because I returned to the basics. And I just remember that feeling, man, like there's no mystery. There's no mystery of some weird thing that I have to do in the perfect combination and get it dialed in and just right and intellectualize it. In fact, every time I tried to intellectualize it, I was just avoiding the work, right? If I'm trying to pick the perfect sponsor, I'm actually trying not to pick a sponsor, right? So I've been following that sense. I can't say that I've done perfect in all areas, you know. I can say in one area that's been really helpful for me is service. I've had a service commitment of some sort ever since then. I think the self-centered nature, self-obsessive fear, self-seeking, just, man, that needs the pressure valve off. And the only way I can get that pressure valve off is to concern myself with the welfare of a meeting, to concern myself with the welfare of a newcomer, to concern myself with the welfare of anything outside of myself. And that's it, man. A guy with more years than me came to me one time and said, I was new in the area, and you walked over to me, and you handed me a meeting guide, and you circled meetings that you would be at. And you said, these are great meetings, man. Hope to see you there. And, you know, like, I've worked sponsees through the steps and stuff like that, and that's beautiful work and stuff. But I was really surprised that that had an impact on that dude. You know, and it was just because that meeting I was responsible for, right? Some meetings need you, some meetings you need. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joel. Thank, let's hear it again for Joel. Honesty is beautiful. Yeah. So we have a lot of food in the back.
And you're more than welcome. We've got Tupperware and...